This isn't just about horsepower.
It's about the culture behind the wheel.
From the latest automotive headlines,
to the machines we love, to the music, movies, and moments driving in the lifestyle.
This is Driveline with Justin Basic. If it's got an engine, an attitude, or a story worth telling, we're on it. Call in. Leave your take. 833-3DL-SHOW. This is Driveline. So let's strap in and let's roll.
Happening. The hantavirus may be in your car now. Driveline back with another one where we talk about whatever I want, but 4 out of 5 times, that's about cars. So I call it sort of car show. But yeah, this is just up from Haggerty. Hantavirus may be hiding in your classic. Here's how to handle it. So, heard a lot about hantavirus last few weeks with everything going on with the cruise ships and that. So in my little email digest, Haggerty put out ways to deal with hantavirus in your car. Vintage and collector vehicles often sit for extended periods of time, occasionally playing host to vermin or rodents. These unwanted guests bring, or more importantly, leave behind remnants that are not only annoying, but can be dangerous to your health. Now, this hits me personally because, as you know, I buy a lot of questionable vehicles, and most notably, my 1968 Fiat 850, potentially from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, my Operazione Dynamite car. Well, I was victim to rodents a few months ago. I hadn't driven it in a while because the generator wasn't charging the battery, so I parked it in the back and just kind of left it. And then one day, I posted on Instagram, my dog's toys were in the frunk, and there was a lot of grass and a lot of poop in the back. So I can relate to this. Rodent droppings and nests can live longer in cars than the animals that made them. I didn't find any of the animals that made them in mine. And that means aging cars can harbor hazardous material without us even knowing. I say this because I have learned the hard way, taking apart a new purchase only to find a nest after nest after nest. I'm not alone either. If this happens to you, here's what you need to know to stay safe. So let's see if I handled this the right way. You might have heard the term tossed around a lot lately, but what is hantavirus and what are the risks? Hantavirus is a name that covers certain types of viruses, originally identified in Korea during the Korean War, with another type identified in the U.S. in 1993. Though rare, these viruses can be deadly, as they often lead to diseases like hantavirus pulmonary syndrome and hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome. I think I said that right. HPS is most common in the United States, but it's possible to contract HFRS in the U.S. too, though it's mostly found in Europe and Asia. Watch out, my Asian listeners. The main carrier of hantavirus in the U.S. is the deer mouse, which we had a lot of in the Midwest. I don't really see them here. Here it's mostly what they call roof rats, which looks like a deer mouse, but about 12 times the size. Everyone who has pickled a vintage car for even just one season has likely been made aware of the risk of mice chewing wires and seat foam along with destroying other materials as they build nests. Pickled a vintage car is such a weird turn of phrase. Those nests appear to be the least annoying part, but can actually be the most dangerous. The main risk of contracting hantavirus is by inhalation or through skin contact, making cleaning these nests out something that should be taken seriously, according to the CDC. The virus can also spread when saliva, urine, or feces from an infected animal gets into a person's skin, eyes, nose, or mouth. If you do find a mouse nest in your car, taking a small amount of extra time to prevent touching or inhaling when removing the nest is prudent. Mask, gloves, and standard household disinfectant like a bleach and water mixture are enough to nearly eliminate the risk of contracting hantavirus. The CDC also recommends airing out a vehicle prior to cleaning and against using a vacuum to clean up nests. Whoops. And to boot, I kind of used a vacuum without the filter because I didn't want to ruin my filter. It was outside, though. I did wear gloves. As it is likely to stir material into the air and make it more likely to be breathed in. Prevention involves making space and hospitable as possible for the rodents, laying traps, and closing up small holes to prevent them from entering. So, yeah. The reason the rats got into my car was because, like all 60s Fiats, it's very rusty, and it may not have floor pans in the back seat. It was kind of just carpet floating over the street. So the rats had crawled up underneath the open floor pan and underneath my back seat and had built a very grassy nest in there, which I've since eradicated, and the entire interior of that car is now in my tool shed, probably getting more rats' nests in it. As I mentioned before, I'm still planning on doing a bit of a fundraiser to get that car back to its former glory, especially if I find out it was actually in the movie. There will be some exclusive merch sold, probably starting in August or September, so be on the lookout for that. But the Italian car everyone's been talking about this week, the new Ferrari Luce. So if you're in the car circle, I'm sorry you're hearing a lot of what's already been said, but I know a lot of my listeners don't follow car news that closely. So, unveiled last week, the Ferrari Luce is Ferrari's first all-electric model. It was designed by the firm Love From. I always want to call it Love Form because I think that would be a better name. Love From is Sir Johnny Ive, who comes from Apple fame, and Mark Newsom. He designed the Ford 21C concept in 1999. It's the notebook-colored car that you've probably seen if you've been in the Peterson in the last year. It was in their concept car exhibit. Yeah, the internet didn't take too kindly to the design. Ferrari's former CEO said it was an affront to the brand. People have been calling it Waymo, Apple Magic Mouse, Fiat Multipla, which I think is a bit extreme. But looking at stats, the Luce is an electric speedster, 5-seater, that blends a 1,035 horsepower quad motor setup with glass-clad aerodynamic design and a starting price of roughly $640,000. Key performance, 1,035 horsepower, the 0 to 60 is under 2.5 seconds, the top speed is 193 miles per hour, and the 122 kilowatt-hour battery pack is capable of 330 miles of range, and it supports up to 350 kilowatt charging, which is more than half the battery in just 20 minutes, and it weighs in at just under 5,000 pounds, which, the stats sound impressive on paper, but is it worth $640,000? Well, in comparison, let's look at the Tesla Model S Plaid, the high-performance version. It offers 1,020 horsepower, which is just 15 horsepower shy of the Luce, and the 0 to 60 time is just 1.99 seconds, which is only, what, 4/5 of the Luce. So it's faster. It weighs in at 4,766 pounds, which is lighter, and is for sale at 1/6 the cost at just $101,630. So, are you really getting any special Ferrari performance from the Luce? No. Can you have the same thing for a lot less money? Yes. So, the design is less than desirable. The performance is that of any high-performance luxury EV brand. But this has been... I'm beating a dead horse. Everyone's been talking about this for the past week. But the new news coming out this week that caught my attention was Pope Leo XIV receives Ferrari Luce's steering wheel. So yeah, the Pope got a visit from Ferrari last week at Castel Gandolfo. Leo had the opportunity to sit in the driver's seat in the new vehicle presented by Ferrari as not only the electric Ferrari, but an entirely new Ferrari. The Italian brand said in the meeting, the Holy Father took place at the papal residence on the morning of Tuesday, May 26th, with a Ferrari delegation led by its chairman, John Elkann, and its CEO, Benedetto Vina. And we have some audio from this.
Is this the first four-door Ferrari?
First five-seater.
First five-seater.
Yes.
It's still weird to me to hear a Pope that just sounds like a normal guy. I mean, I was so excited when they announced the new Pope. I'm not only he's from the United States, he's from Chicago. I am a Chicago-born, Catholic-raised person, so big win for us, but it's still weird hearing the Pope like just sound like a normal guy. But the other thing that's interesting to me about this clip, Ferrari completely dodged his question.
Is this the first four-door Ferrari?
First five-seater.
First five-seater.
Yes.
But no, it's not the first four-door Ferrari. All true enthusiasts know the first four-door Ferrari was the Ferrari 456 Venice sedan built by Pininfarina for the Brunei car collection sometime in the 90s. There was probably about, Tim Fabrizio would know the actual number, but 10 or 12 four-door Ferraris in that collection, and there were no four-door Ferraris outside of that collection. But first, no. In a statement, the Italian brands, we read that. Elkann said, it was a great emotion and immense honor to meet with His Holiness together with my Ferrari colleagues, noting that it was a moment of extraordinary human and symbolic value, which inspired everyone at our company to continue on its path with passion, responsibility, and confidence in the future. He added that at the meeting with Leo was an occasion that will remain forever etched in our memory and in the history of Ferrari. In promoting its new vehicle, the Italian brand highlights both its mechanical performance and its energy efficiency.
The real interface with every Ferrari, and Lucio as well, is on the red switch over there. We call it Manettino because it comes from Formula One experience, where the pilot can change the setting of the cars. Oh. And it's exactly the transfer we move also to the normal road cars.
I love His Holiness's because I didn't understand any of what he was saying. Let's listen again.
The real interface with every Ferrari, and Lucio as well.
Okay, I got Lucio out of that.
He's on the red switch over there. We call it Manettino. Because
red switch?
Does it come from Formula One experience?
Formula One?
It's where the pilot can change the setting of...
Pilot can change the setting.
Cars, no. And it's exactly the transfer that we move also to the normal road cars.
But yeah, Pope Leo was gifted a Ferrari Luce steering wheel to accompany another steering wheel Ferrari gave him in the past. But hey, Jim Farley from Ford gave him a whole custom-built Explorer, built in Chicago, mind you. So maybe spend your money on a different car brand. Okay, my take. So everyone's tuning in because they have been dying to know what Justin Basak thinks of the Ferrari EV. Some notes I had. The moving screen in the center console is clever. But I also think it looks like an afterthought, like most unintegrated into the dash screens. It kind of reminds me of the computer we use in the emergency vehicles with the fire department. The suicide doors in the back are always a plus. The rear taillights look lifted right off the back of my 2005 Impala, which personally I like, but make of that what you will. I really like the thin steering wheel. The switchgear is great. There is a lot of actual physical switches in this car. It's not just all captive touch and screens, which Ferrari has been putting in a lot of their newer cars in the last years. They're going back to switches, which the customer wants. They actually integrated toggle switches into the screen, which I think is cool. And no one so far has talked about how cool the lever is on the ceiling to activate launch control. It's like a switch you can grab with your whole hand and twist. And another interesting detail, there appears to be an analog clock integrated into the screen. It might be part of the screen, but analog clocks are always good. At face value, I think it's an interesting car that is right for someone. I mean, if this car had a Hyundai or Kia badge, I think it'd be excellent. Or even a Honda badge. In fact, I got a proposal for this car that I haven't heard anyone say yet. So hear me out. License this design to Honda. They're already selling the GM-built EV, the Prologue, basically a rebadged Chevy Blazer, which is being canceled in December because no one's been buying any of Honda's EVs. So, Honda sponsors Autopia. And last week we talked about how Disneyland is having to make Autopia all electric because of smog regulations. So, make the new Luce the cars on the Autopia ride. It fits right in. The design fits right in with a Simo and Bird. I think this would look really cool. Awaiting my letter saying I'm banned from all Ferraris. if you want a good looking Ferrari, for half the price, Copart right now has listed a 1964 Ferrari 330. It's not clear yet whether the title on it is clean or salvage, but it's a California title. 54,694 miles on the odometer. It's got a Ferrari V12. The primary damage is listed as vandalism, which I don't see any damage at all on this car. And the estimated retail value is $329,625. So for half the price of the Luce, probably would get it from Copart for a little less than that. And it's a running and driving car, so. Classic Ferraris have always seemed ridiculous in price, but compared to the Luce, there's probably a lot of 330s and 250s that are in the competitive price range. 833-3DL-SHOW, that's 833-335-7469, to leave us a voicemail like this guy did.
Hey, Justin, listening to your last show with the call-in from Gloria to the Motorman show with her problem got me inspired. So I'm going to try and be like her. Here's a problem I'm having. Can we talk tractors on this show?
No, go away.
We're going to talk about my 1968 Ford 4000 tractor with a three-cylinder gas engine. Lately, when we are starting it and it's cranking, there's like a new screeching noise, and it only lasts while it's cranking. As soon as it's running, it goes away. But I guess that's got me wondering, do I need to lubricate the starter? Is it the starter that's screeching? You know what? Rather than trying to describe it, let me just have it make the noise for you here. Hope that came through on the phone. Thanks. Bye.
So, what Eric's referencing is a couple of weeks ago, I went to an estate sale from the motorman, Leon Kaplan, up in Encino there, and bought some memorabilia from his house. But it got us. I never listened to the Motorman show. It was on KBC for like 40 years. I'm a Drive Chicago guy, so I never really paid attention to what they were doing on this side of the country, but Leon Kaplan had a show called The Motorman for like 40 years, KABC. We were listening back to a little bit of it. And he had a caller named Gloria, who was probably 100 years old. And she was having a problem. She had an early 90s Nissan Sentra or similar. And it wasn't starting when it was cold out. Cold and damp. And she thought it was her battery, but he was telling her it wasn't her battery. They ultimately concluded it was a cold start sensor, but we got this clip out of that.
Oh, my engine.
So, going back to Eric's question, I can't really hear what you're talking about from the clip. Like, let's listen to this again. There's a little bit of a screech in there. It starts up pretty quickly, so I don't think the starter itself is going out or the solenoid. Let's listen again closer. I assume that car uses, or that tractor uses off-the-shelf Ford parts in 68, like based on the starters I have on my 70 Cadillac and my 63 Corvair. I've never seen a starter you have to lubricate, so I don't think lubricating the starter would be the case here, unless farm equipment used something else. But based on what I know about starters and the fact that the starter is engaging, so, I mean, I'm not going to go with hit it on a hammer or anything, but what I would do is pop the bolts holding the starter in, pull the starter, and look at the teeth on that gear. Chances are the teeth are starting to wear off on where it's engaging there. And if the teeth look fine on the starter, take a look at the flywheel and just get a large socket wrench and rotate around one rotation of the engine and just check all the teeth there on the flywheel, because if it's still engaging but it's making noise, chances are there's some gear slippage, which I've heard of happening before. And you might either need a new starter or hopefully not a new flywheel on the engine. But based on what you're saying, that's where I would think that would go. Police arrest man for trying to pass off NASCAR race truck as a street legal Chevy S10. So, I found this interesting because I've often thought about dabbling and buying an old race car, but I don't race on the track, so I'd want to buy one I can drive on the street. So, let's see what happened here. So, Pennsylvania man. Expect it to be Florida man, but no, Pennsylvania man faces felony, fraud, theft, and deception charges after state police accused him of illegally disguising a NASCAR race truck as street legal. Pennsylvania State Police issued a press release, which I have right here. Williamsport man arrested on multiple felony charges and race truck fraud scheme. Out of Carlisle, PA, Pennsylvania State Police, Troop H. Carlisle announces the arrest of Yancey Cup. I think if anyone's going to do a NASCAR scheme, it's going to be someone named Yancey Cup. Age 52 of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, on multiple felony and misdemeanor charges, stemming from a scheme to fraudulently title and sell a retired professional NASCAR race truck as a street legal passenger vehicle. Cup was charged with dealing in proceeds of unlawful activities, alteration or destruction of a vehicle identification number, disposition of a vehicle with an altered vehicle identification number, theft by deception, forgery, criminal use of a communication facility, deceptive business practices, false application of a certificate of title or registration, tampering with public records, and board of vehicle violations and deceptive vehicle advertisements.
Deserting his wife and children, citing prostitution, kidnapping, extortion, receiving stolen goods, selling stolen goods, passing counterfeit money, and contrary to the laws of this state, the condemned is guilty of using marked cards and loaded dice. Therefore, according to the powers vested in us, we sentence the accused here before us to Cole Benedict.
Yancey Cup.
Juan Maria Ramirez.
Known as the Rat.
And any other aliases he might have. To hang by the neck until dead. May God have mercy on his soul. Proceed.
An investigation revealed Cup purchased a retired professional race truck from a NASCAR Truck Series driver and subsequently installed fraudulent vehicle identification number plate taken from an unrelated vehicle. Cup then used that fraudulent VIN to obtain a Pennsylvania certificate of title, despite the race truck never having had a title or VIN in any state. Cup advertised the race truck on eBay as a street-legal 1999 Chevrolet S10, falsely claiming the vehicle had been converted to street use by its former NASCAR owner, a claim the former owner explicitly denied. The vehicle was subsequently sold at Carlisle Auto Auction in Cumberland County for $10,000. A physical examination of the vehicle by investigators confirmed it was not street legal. Right now you can find a NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series racer for sale on Carlisle's site. It features pretty much everything you'd expect to see on a converted race vehicle, like a license plate, inspection sticker, even an admission sticker. It also has high and low beam headlights, blinkers, and a horn. Photos show the truck when it ran at the NASCAR Bristol Dirt Race in 2023. It looks almost identical now, except the headlights and taillights are functional units. The truck's previous iteration only had stickers to make it look like they were present. The Silverado body truck even runs the same 406 cubic inch V8 as it did back in its glory days. Exactly what's necessary to make competition vehicle street legal varies between states. Some argue that the truck should have met the requirements. It featured headlights, taillights, blinkers, and a horn. However, the Pennsylvania State Police clearly does not agree. So as I was perusing through my saved Instagram reels, I did find something similar to this that I saved a couple months ago. It comes from Cameron Rana Cars. And he himself has a street legal converted NASCAR. And he goes through a little bit on what it took to achieve that.
How do you even get a title and VIN for a NASCAR? Now, I bought this one specifically because it already had a title, which the hard part of getting these street legal is getting a VIN and a title for it. But I was looking for a while, so I did look into the process of how to get a VIN for one of these. And it's by getting a VIN for it as a kit car, which is a very common process for cars like these, the Shelby Cobras and Shelby Daytona replicas. This NASCAR got its VIN in Minnesota, giving it one of these blue stickers from the state of Minnesota that states it's an assigned VIN, not an original VIN. However, what I don't know is how they got this titled as a 1999 Ford Taurus. But my guess is they had a friend at the DMV that helped them out and got it titled as a Ford Taurus.
The firm Dirt Legal advertises on their website they can help you register your street legal race car in the U.S. And they go through a little bit on the procedure to do that. They state that the requirements for light vehicles, cars, trucks, and motorcycles are handled on a state-by-state basis. And the Federal Department of Transportation doesn't explicitly state the requirements. But generally, requirements are seat belts, two headlights, turn signals front and rear, two brake lights on the rear, third brake light often not required, two mirrors, one interior and one on the vehicle's driver's side, license plate lamps, and reverse lamps. They also state basically the procedure they're going to do for you. They will basically give you a Vermont title. Well, if the car is old enough, they claim, in Vermont, cars older than 15 years are not required to have a title at all. Instead, the state of Vermont issues what's called a transferable registration, which you can then do one of two things with. You could either take the transferable registration to your home state DMV and transfer it and get a new title, or you can opt to have Vermont license plates sent out as part of their package. Specifically recommended for Californians, Texans, Floridians, and New Yorkers who have very strict car registration inspections. Cameron also goes on to discuss the struggle he had insuring his street legal NASCAR.
But even with a VIN and a title, insuring this thing is a whole nother process. Before I bought this, I reached out to Haggerty, who advertises themselves as the collector car and kit car insurance company. They denied insuring this. Their excuse was that it was past their 1998 cutoff date for collector cars. But to add insult to injury, they told me it was previously insured by them by the previous owner because they had a history with Haggerty. So they made an exception for him. Then proceeded to tell me if I wanted to insure my cars with them for 5 to 10 years, they might make an exception for me.
I've had Haggerty insurance now for 8 years. I need to get Brian on here and ask him if I can get an exception made for me for a race car.
Which obviously left a bad taste in my mouth. So I went to Progressive, who also has kit car and agreed value insurance. And after a short phone call with them, disclosing that this was a kit car and heavily modified, I got this insured for an agreed value. And I really wasn't expecting Progressive to actually insure this. So I looked into it further, and a lot of other street legal NASCAR owners use local insurance or specialty performance and drag car insurance.
The moral of the story is, if you're building a kit car or trying to register your street legal race car, don't VIN swap. It never ends well. There are legal pathways to it. Depending on where you live, it might be more difficult, but especially in California, everything's more difficult here. Which leads me to, this is one of my favorite stories from the past couple weeks. Applying to California. How a disgruntled man in his 2001 Volvo got the Cars for Kids jingle banned.
1-877 Cars for Kids.
If you've ever heard the 1-877 Cars for Kids jingle, you've probably heard it a million times. In states where this car donation charity operates, it's been running obnoxiously repetitive singing kids ads for decades, with the intensity of a shock and awe military campaign. But after all those years of operation, one disgruntled donor took it to court and got a judge to kick Cars for Kids off California airwaves for practicing an actionable strategy of deception. While the song is undoubtedly annoying, that's not why it's been ordered off the air, as laid out in the New York Times, ABC 7, and elsewhere. Judge Cassia Apkarian of the Superior Court of California in Orange County found that Cars for Kids ads violated the state's laws against false advertising and unfair competition. More specifically, the judge did not like that the Cars for Kids ads have no disclosures about the organization's religious affiliation. As stated in the court ruling, the problem is that the cars were not for kids at all. Cars for Kids' own COO, SD Landau, testified that the group operates no functional programs for helping kids in California. The money mainly goes to URA, an organization dedicated to Jewish heritage and summer camps in New York and New Jersey. Ms. Landau explicitly testified that the organization's primary purpose is not to help economically disadvantaged children. She testified that URA's programs include matchmaking for young adults and gap year trips to Israel for 17 and 18-year-olds, averaging 250 participants per year. The article goes on, nothing wrong with funding gap year religious mixers for 18-year-olds, but it's a far cry from the underprivileged kids the ads imply are saved by your 200,000-mile trade-in. The Israeli link to Cars for Kids is not a new discovery. It only takes casual research to find the connection between Cars for Kids and URA. And it's funny, too, because in research for this segment, I found a lot of videos I had forgotten I'd watched on YouTube, and more are coming out of the surface now showing where Cars for Kids' money is actually going, and you can dig very deeply down that rabbit hole. But it's not apparent in the ads, and that's the crux of plaintiff Bruce Peterbarg's problem here. And yes, we're getting back to the old Volvo. The court ruling describes his vehicle as a 2001 Volvo Cross Country, and they imagine they're referring to the Volvo V70 Cross Country, since the XC90 was not out that year. Which, I really like the Volvo V70. I actually have one that's been promised to me that I'm waiting on, so anxiously awaiting that. After donating the car, he learned from a neighbor that the proceeds would fund a Jewish organization based in the Northeast. Mr. Pruderbog said that he felt taken advantage of, as the New York Times wrote. The plaintiff testified he was subjected to the Cars for Kids radio jingle repeatedly, over and over. The jingle that was played in court several times is the TV version. It features several children aged 8 to 10 playing various musical instruments, with the jingle repeated at least 4 times. The short repetitive jingle ad has the following lyrics. Plaintiff testified that as a charitable person, he relied on the advertisement's auditory message to conclude that the organization benefited underprivileged kids from all over the U.S., and specifically kids in California, given that he was donating the vehicle in California. The plaintiff donated the 2001 Volvo Cross Country valued at $250. He testified that he felt taken advantage of upon discovering only after the donation that the funds did not stay in California but supported a specific religious mission in the Northeast. The court finds that the plaintiff credibly testified that the plaintiff believed the charity benefited underprivileged kids from all over the U.S. and expected a donation made in California would benefit children in California. Now, as of, what is it, June 3rd, there are still Cars for Kids ads running across all the radio stations I work for. But little misleading in the article that it's been banned. Cars for Kids has 30 days to add some kind of deeper disclosure to its ads or keep them off the air in the state of California. So that 30-day deadline is coming up. So will we not hear these ads on California airwaves anymore? Well, as I found on Cars for Kids' website, their official statement, and they have no plans on cutting off these ads anytime soon. Update is of May 28, 2026, in the case of Peter Barg versus Cars for Kids. The court decision got it wrong, and the resulting damage is not limited to the courtroom. The Orange County Court ruling, this is right off their website, the Orange County Court ruling presents a Jewish charity's work through a distorted and incendiary lens, creating a narrative that Cars for Kids deceived the public, hid its Jewish mission, and diverted charitable funds to something suspect. The facts are neither new nor concealed. Cars for Kids has long made it clear it primarily funds URA. It provides substantial financial assistance to approximately 2,200 preschool, elementary, and high school students aged 5 to 17 attending more than 250 schools across the United States and Canada. It operates free extracurricular programming for children ages 8 to 15 in more than 80 locations in 20 states. Hundreds of more children aged 10 to 17 receive free one-on-one membership and tutoring through URA. These programs serve families from many states beyond New York and New Jersey, including California. Yet Judge Aspikarian's decision largely disregarded this evidence. Instead, it highlighted two comparatively small programs as though they defined the organization. And on their update back from May 15th, throws even more shade at the plaintiff. Cars for Kids believe the evidence at trial showed the following. Bruce Peterbog had an abandoned car on his property. It was left there by someone who had been staying at his house. The title to the car was not in his name. For months, he meant to get rid of the vehicle, but never got around to it. Finally, with a party he was hosting around the corner, he had to dispose of it. Cars for Kids offered just what he needed, a quick, free, and easy way to get rid of the car. Mr. Peterbog reached out to Cars for Kids to have them pick it up. Pickup went smoothly, and he got exactly what he sought. He riddled himself of the car without any cost. Days later, his neighbor, a lawyer, heard the donation, and after Mr. Peterbog spoke with the attorney, who shared with him that Cars for Kids is a Jewish charity, the lawsuit began. After he brought his complaint to Cars for Kids' attention, Cars for Kids offered him the car back, as it had not yet been sold or junked. With the vehicle returned, he could donate it to another charity, but he refused to take it. That was not surprising, after all. The car was a hassle he didn't want. It was unclear what kind of damages he could claim if he was making a charitable donation of a car he never wanted or needed. They go on to say that Cars for Kids ads have one purpose, to remind listeners that Cars for Kids offers a quick and easy way to dispose of an unused vehicle. The ads are targeted to vehicle owners and not specifically people considering donating to charity. The ads invite listeners considering donating to contact the organization via phone or web, at which point there is ample opportunity to learn more about the charity work and communities the organization supports before donating. Mr. Peter Bogg himself testified that all of the information he claimed he did not know was readily available when he later looked at the Cars for Kids website, which viewers are directed to in the advertisements. They go on to note, is Cars for Kids stopping to advertise in California? They are pursuing all legal options available, including seeking a stay on the injunction and appealing the ruling, which we believe strongly that we will win an appeal because the law and the facts are on our side. We care too much about the thousands of kids committed to help. We've committed to help just to give up. Sorry, but the jingle is not going away so fast.
1-877 Cars for Kids. KARS Cars for Kids.
But someone who did ban this jingle, the CBC out of Canada. CBC pulls Cars for Kids jingle after U.S. court bans deceptive jingle. CBC will no longer carry ads for Cars for Kids, the long-running charity campaign featuring a familiar jingle inviting audience to donate your car today. Public broadcaster announced on Tuesday, days after California court found the campaign to be a strategy of deception. In light of the developments regarding the charity, CBC has decided to pull their ads. Chuck Thompson, a spokesperson for Crown Corporation, told CBC News in an email. In Canada, URA is listed as a registered charity with the Federal Reserve Agency. Canada tax filings showed the organization transferred $12.6 million to the U.S. and Israel in the fiscal year ending May 31st, 2025. The most recent data available for projects such as the Texas Torah Institute and the Cincinnati Hebrew Day School. URA's Canada Revenue Agency filings show $19 million in expenditures in the 2024-2025 fiscal year, including $3.7 million on advertising and promotion. A Cars for Kids spokesperson did not respond to emailed questions about whether any of the proceeds raised in Canada go to help children in Canada. The filings list no director for URA in Canada. The Cars for Kids Canadian headquarters is listed as a shared office space in downtown Toronto. The charity has no staff at the location when a reporter visited the address last week. A receptionist said no one is here physically and that Cars for Kids Canada is only online. Underlined, Cars for Kids Canada is a separate organization and not a party to this matter. But yeah, Cars for Kids claims a new wave of media and online commentators continue to amplify the false impression that URA is essentially a birthright plus J-date rather than a broad Jewish youth services organization. Well, in light of all this, I've jumped in to fill in a hole in this market, whether or not the Cars for Kids jingles go away. And I threw together a little jingle of my own.
1-833-3DL-SHOW. SHOWDL-SHOW. 1-833-3DL-SHOW. Give away your car today.
At Driveline, we'll take your running or non-running car for free, quick and easy, with zero tax deduction. Because you'd rather give your car away than have it used so teenagers can have a gap year.
Driveline also accepts motorcycles, boats, entertainment memorabilia, model trains, real trains, and real estate in exchange for no compensation.
Always happy to take cars you don't want. I'm sure they're in the way, cluttering up the driveway. You don't want that $250 tax receipt you'll never use. Do me a favor, leave a 5-star rating on your favorite platform, screenshot and tag at driveline.show, and just back that you're listening, help grow the show. 833-335-7469, call the driveline. Buymeacoffee.com/driveline. We'll do this all again next week with guest Lauren Fix. Bye-bye now.